And welcoming you, dear listeners, to this Sunday morning session. And obviously, as you heard there, in terms of bringing us through in, well, sort of like the introduction or the start of this morning's particular show or this morning's particular programming, obviously, it's 5:15. Good morning if you've just woken up or you've been awake since a while back, And welcome to my Sunday morning take on this lovely Sunday morning session here on your number one talk radio station. Now, obviously, as we always venture into the discussions of everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, the conversation obviously is not one that always stops it, but the one that actually helps to spur on, you know, a greater understanding or a greater discussion of, you know, how the world actually works around us, which also includes some of the things that we humans have also basically contributed or created or were, you know, responsible for in periods gone by. Now, getting into the particular indications, of course, of this morning's particular program, and remember, you're in my company all the way from 5 a.m. up until 6 a.m. It's not 6 a.m., sorry, up until 7 a.m., and that's obviously in terms of as we go through the particular motions and indications in terms of, you know, what's actually going on and around of this morning's particular subject matter. Now, starting off on our discussion for this morning, as you obviously would be sitting there with either a cup of tea or something warm or a cup of coffee, I cannot prescribe to you what you, you know, that's what you love or, you know, wake up with. We obviously take a look at a significant piece of human history that takes us back to what would be the first particular indications of, well, not the very, very, very first particular indications of multilateral get-together or multilateral organizations that is meant to take us as humanity to the next level or take us forward in terms of peaceful coexistence and peaceful engagements and not finding war as the last resort of everything, but rather as a, I don't want to say it's a last resort, but it should never be the actual, you know, the actual answer. Now, in many cases, dear listeners, if you go and look back at the precursor organization that existed before the United Nations, that being the League of Nations, you always go and look at the question of why did the League of Nations fail? Now, the League of Nations description or the aspect in terms of that would be identified as to why did the League of Nations fail is that they always lay it at the blame or they lay it at the particular singular event of Japan invading Manchuria. Now, if you don't know where Manchuria is, it is a province or an area in northern China that borders onto Mongolia, and the description sometimes associated to this particular, you know, reasoning is that this was a aspect of, you know, this is the singular most significant event that led to the collapse of the League of Nations between the other parties as well. Now, back in last year, just before Christmas, or just before the end of the year session specifically in terms of last year's particular, you know, time frame running out, I had a specific, also my Sunday morning take discussion based upon the, what was the peace plan all about that Woodrow Wilson had suggested, Now, the peace plan was supposedly like a 7-point thing, but that was obviously at the start of everything, just before the League of Nations was brought into effect. Here, we're talking about a scenario as to what were the negotiations going on that led to the failure of the League of Nations. Now, when I say failure, I'm not speaking about how it could not act. I'm talking about how the thing did not even have the right idea behind it to be successful. Now, I know you might be frowning, going like, the right idea behind it to be successful? Yes, the right idea behind it to be successful. For example, dear listeners, there is something today known as the UN Charter, that all member nations and their governments subscribe to, except for North Korea and except for Myanmar. There's one more country apparently that's not there that I thought about. That's not at, there's 200 and something countries, but yeah, I think it's Haiti. Yeah, I think it's Haiti. And when you look at the aspect in terms of the UN Charter itself, the UN Charter espouses a discussion which is one about universality, and that technically wherever you come from, you are considered a human. You have rights, your country has rights, and stuff like that. So as to lay the foundation in terms of, it's a scenario of respect. It's a scenario of identifying that there are people who should be respected. Or all people should be respected. Now, as I'm saying that particular statement to you, that particular, minute detail, which you would go like, that should be a given. That should be a automatic, an automatic clause that should be there. Well, you are right. But the thing is, when the League of Nations began, it was not an automatic clause. It was not even allowed to be there. People were trying to negotiate around the clarity of such a particular clause when the League of Nations was established. And people were trying to understand, to what extent this particular clause should translate to a universal scope. Now, when I say to a universal scope, there were a whole bunch of things happening in the 1920s. And if you don't know what these bunch of things were in the 1920s, we will be getting into one of them, specifically the architect as to what led to the failure of the League of Nations. Because this will actually help to set the scene specifically as to what happened with Abyssinia, which was one of Africa's last independent states, besides Liberia, obviously, because it was a kingdom, Abyssinia. It was the collection of Eritrea, Ethiopia, Somalia, and there's another, and Djibouti. They were one territory together. And if you get to understand why that particular country was attacked by another, former League of Nations entity, which was Italy at the time, Italy led by Mussolini at the time, you will also understand as to, what the particular subject matter behind this meant. In terms of that single clause that all humans are equal not being stipulated in the founding statements of the League of Nations. But before we continue, dear listeners, we're quickly going to take a short break, and we're going to come back right after this musical break. We'll be right back. And that there were the sounds of Jamiroquai with the song, two completely different things. And this obviously means you've returned back to my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station here on Eagle FM. Now, as we step back into where we left off with our discussion, dear listeners, it obviously gets us into the aspect of, you know, where we see the particular developments of what led to the fall, if I can say the fall, or if I can say the failure of the League of Nations. Now, the League of Nations, dear listeners, was supposed to be this revolutionary get-together, multilateral discussion based upon how do we achieve, you know, common peace around the world after what was deemed the Great War. But obviously that particular war, the First World War, was then sort of like surpassed by the Second World War and its particular sacrifices or its particular investments that went into it, as well as also a lot of the other particular things that obviously made it look even more nastier than a conflict, because in many cases, it wasn't actually the invasions that made the Second World War look bad. It was the, all the other things that were taking place around the invasions of European countries by Germany at the start, at the time. Now, when you get into the understanding specifically of, you know, what happened. Now, remember, I started off with a subject matter just before the musical break based upon a thing that was supposed to be a universally accepted concept. Now, what happened at the treaty, it was known as the Treaty of Versailles. You did it in high school. We all looked into it. You know, the discussions was taking place there, but no one spoke actually about what actually went down in the negotiations that led to the Treaty of Versailles. We only got the summary that says, yeah, was it Germany and Turkey and Austria were made to pay reparations. That's it. And then we fast forward into the 1920s, leading into the 1930s, which was the Great Depression. That's it. We just slid from here, 1918, on a banana peel into the 1930s, building up to the Second World War. Because you are shown that timeline. You are literally guided on high school, in high school history, on that specific path. But you don't go and look, you don't get the opportunity to look into what it meant specifically for being in the, you know, what were some of the contributing discussions, negotiations, and who were the actors of the day, meaning the politicians of the day, contributing to these things. Now, this leads us into the three peace treaty negotiations that obviously took place. Now, one of the literature resources that I've got with me is one coming through from the Australian government itself, because one of their prime ministers at the time, known as William Hughes, or his other nickname, Billy Hughes, was a very prominent individual at the negotiations. Now, he obviously showed up there as the Prime Minister of Australia, the Prime Minister of Canada at the time was there, and the Prime Minister of New Zealand and South Africa were also there. Now, if you don't know what this translated to, was that these guys were part of the Dominion of the UK. They were known as the Dominion States of the UK at the time. And these countries, these four countries, they were also allowed to have a say. Now, if you don't know what that translates to, specifically, these are countries that in some case were colonies, were no longer colonies, but in some cases, rather to some extent, they were still partly affiliated in great length in terms of the economic as does also the security policies and international relations policies of the United Kingdom. Now, at the 11th hour of, on 11 November 1918, an armistice being that it's almost like a peace treaty situation. An armistice was signed and the gun and, you know, all gunfire actually fell silent on the Western Front. Now, this is as the preparations immediately afterwards, you know, the armistice, which is technically a surrender slash, you know, let's stop shooting at each other, negotiation or agreement began. Was that the preparations began for a peace conference to negotiate a treaty. Now, at that time, the Australian Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, was determined to protect Australian interests in the peace negotiations. Now, he was concerned that Britain, at the time, would not put Australia's interests first and Australia would be threatened by other countries wrestling for power in the Pacific. Now, there's one other superpower, or there's actually were two superpowers in the Pacific Ocean region, that being Japan to the north and the United States, you know, heading eastwards from, if you're from, speaking from Australia's perspective, you know, that's eastwards. Now, Hughes, this is now as the negotiations were going on, because they were busy with something else happening there. Hughes insisted that the self-governing British dominions of Australia, Canada, and New Zealand should have the right to put forward their claims. It was the first time that Australia had a voice on the world stage. Now, Hughes argued that the Australian nation had earned its right by the great sacrifice and loss of life that it had made in fighting the war, meaning they apparently lost like 60,000 Australians to the, you know, the, in the First World War. The Australians were predominantly kept or were predominantly fighting in the Middle East. Yeah. At that time, the Suez Canal had existed, so it was easy for the British to transport supplies and soldiers through the Suez Canal to the Middle East. Because one of the countries that the British were fighting against were the Ottomans. The Ottomans were the precursor name of Turkey, today known as Turkey. So the Ottomans were obviously in the Middle East. Now, this then obviously sees that the American President Woodrow Wilson from the USA questioned Hughes's authority to intervene in world affairs because he was speaking for only 5 million people at the time. That was Australia's population at the time. And Hughes replied by saying, "I speak for 60,000 dead. For how many do you speak?" Now, Hughes insisted that Germany should pay for the full cost of the war and not just for the damages that it had caused. Now, the final treaty included a controversial war guilt clause, which was technically literally what led to the Second World War, that particular clause. Because if you don't know, in the 1930s, Germany actually walks away also from the League of Nations. Or actually, you know, the failed Austrian painter goes and says, "You know what, we will not pay any of these things. And we will not, you know, abide by any further particular reparations that need to be paid from the First World War's particular damage." So, the clause was used to argue that Germany should fully compensate all Allied nations. Germany was eventually asked to pay £6.6 billion at the time. Australia had incurred a war debt of £275 million. The average weekly earnings at the time was around £3. Many people believe this insistence on war guilt and the punishing compensation payments contributed to the rise of the failed Austrian painter, that being Hitler, and the conditions that caused the Second World War. Now, Hughes, and this is the main thing as to what technically led to the collapse of the League of Nations. Hughes had a racial equality clause removed. He had it removed. Because he was campaigning and lobbying, obviously, there in the treaty at the Palace of Versailles in Paris. He had a racial equality clause removed from the covenant of the League of Nations. The covenant is, if you understand the UN Charter as the founding document of the UN, the covenant of the League of Nations, it was also the founding document of the League of Nations, similar to what the UN Charter is. The Japanese proposal would have guaranteed the equal treatment of people in Australia. All people in Australia. Not just European settlers. All people in Australia. This, it would also have had a cascading influence into South Africa, into New Zealand, and into Canada. If you understand what I particularly mean there, is that there were a lot of indigenous populations in all of those four UK or British Dominion states that were participating in the negotiations of the Treaty of Versailles, which is also known as the Peace Treaty. Now, Hughes had this particular clause that was put forward by the Japanese delegation at the time, so as specifically to maintain a specific policy that he was busy conducting back in Australia. Now, said particular policy was meant to Europe. It was almost to, like, you know, greatly amplify the European population base in Australia. Now, I will get to what that specific policy meant and what it spoke to, because we actually have to get into what the negotiations actually look like on the ground as well, meaning what happened between when the Japanese were not happy or before even the Japanese had the opportunity of making their particular proposal. So, Hughes felt, specifically, you know, with regards to the racial equality proposal, he felt that this was a threat to the white Australia that was being enshrined in Australia's Immigration and Restriction Act. We will still get to it. Don't worry. We will still get to it. Now, this act had wide community support at the time in Australia. Now, Hughes also fought for the control of the former German territories in the South Pacific. The US president at the time opposed Japan's plan to annex the former German colonies north of the equator. He also opposed Hughes's plan for Papua New Guinea. And to prevent Japan from gaining territory, Hughes compromised and agreed to a system of mandates. These mandates allowed Australia to take control of Papua New Guinea in a trust, put that in inverted commas, for its people. Now, Hughes fought to establish Australia's security and independence in the Pacific and to preserve a European Australia. But his achievements meant different things to different people, because to some, this particular battle represented a new maturity for Australia as a whole in terms of its diplomacy. And to others, it also demonstrated ties with the old world, which was obviously the ties to colonialism. Now, this then actually brings us into what was the racial equality proposal that was brought forward by the Japanese. Now, remember, the Japanese were the bad guys in the Second World War, but they were actually the good guys, or part of the club of good guys. But not if you consider the British and the French at the time being good guys, because they were sitting with colonial possessions. So, in essence, the British and the French didn't practice something known as racial equality at the time in 1918. It was something else, you know, that they were obviously insured of or in charge of. Now, at the peace treaty proposals, each country obviously had insights, obviously had proposals, suggestions, and they were putting down all these particular things in the various negotiations that were ongoing in the Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles in Paris. The Palace of Versailles is now actually, I think it's the Presidential Palace, the French Presidential Palace. And all this was, you know, going on there in France specifically. Now, All the victorious or standing nations were obviously the ones that were negotiating things. The Germans were apparently just to the side, them and the Austrians, I think. The Russians weren't there because the Russians became communist in 1915 or 16. And they obviously were standing to the side of things. The, who else was the other country? That was also, that became a bad guy technically also just a few years later. Yeah. Italy were also, you know, contributing the, you know, greatly to the covenant itself. And so the negotiations were obviously ongoing. Obviously Britain showed up with the biggest voice because Britain had South Africa, in the form of Jan Smuts, who was the prime minister then. They had the Canadian prime minister at the time. And remember, Jan Smuts himself was literally a wartime South African general. He was a South African general at the time who actually fought in the First World War. Smuts was also in the, I think, did he ever go to the Second World War as well? Because he does have a military career behind him. He did fight. He was in the South African Army, or in what was known as the South African Army, part of the broader British Army presence. And you obviously had the Australians and the New Zealanders there. So if I illustrate to you that technically the UK or the British showed up there as five, you know, voices, not as one voice. They showed up as five voices, which would obviously intimidate the mastermind of the League of Nations, that being Woodrow Wilson, because he was American, and his French counterpart, the French Prime Minister at the time, and obviously the Japanese. All of them would all have been, you know, a little bit intimidated, because the British were the only guys showing up there as a squad of five. Five voices, but five voices supporting each other. Now, the racial equality proposal that was put forward by the Japanese, which was known as the proposal to abolish racial discrimination. You see, if this proposal went through in 1918, it would have meant specifically that so many communities around the world, so many particular subjugated populations, in colonial discussions back then, would have achieved earlier independence. Now, this was an amendment to the Treaty of Versailles that was considered at the 1919 Paris Peace Conference. Now, though it was broadly supported, even Woodrow Wilson supported it. Although it was broadly supported, even what was the Prime Minister, the British Prime Minister at the time? Lloyd George. Yeah, even Lloyd George supported it in principle, because Lloyd George was very much well aware of the government structures that Canada, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand had at the time. Now, Alex, you will probably have heard in great length in terms of the recent developments that have happened in Canada since COVID, specifically regarding how the education system was used to kill hundreds of Native American or Native Canadian children who were being put through a, what do they call that program? It's like a, but it was a large scale education program that was conducted by the Catholic Church on behalf of the Canadian state. And this was in some case to try and, I know that education is an equalizer, dear listeners, but in many cases there are many groups of people around the world who don't want to conform to a forced system, you know, when you force them into this situation. So what happens with the Native Canadian children, because Canada is different, I can't say American, Canada is different, you know, different territory from the U.S., was that a lot of them died from all kinds of sicknesses, as well as also maltreatment in these schools. These schools were considered, they were like boarding schools, meaning your child goes away and stays in the hostel there in that school, and the child is there most of the time, only comes back from those particular settings or institutions during holidays. Most of those children had to live there. All kinds of violence was committed against these children, which led to, you know, a bad track record popping up here in 2021, 2022, which actually forced the former Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, he had to give a formal apology because it was a Canadian government education policy that led to the demise of so many, lives of children of, you know, of native Canadian, tribes and communities. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can go look it up, dear listeners. It was a national scandal. Now, the unfortunate thing is, it didn't happen under Trudeau's watch. It was something that happened literally in the 1920s, from the 19-teens, from the 1900s, building up to, I think, 1950 was when the last one of these particular institutions supposedly, was still in existence. And, you know, the horror stories just keep coming up, because what happened was literally that someone wanted to build something at what was once an old site of one of these schools, and they came across a mass grave. The parents were never told that the children had passed away or died. The parents were never allowed the opportunity of interrogating why their child never came back home from school. Can you believe it? The children just contracted all manner of illnesses, diseases. They weren't given first aid help or any particular kind of medical treatment. Their demise was as a result specifically of maltreatment and not positioning any particular support mechanisms close to the health of a child. And thus, most of these children passed away. Now, it then gets us into the particular discussions, obviously, that the principle of the racial equality proposal was revisited after the war and incorporated into the UN Charter in 1945. So I'm talking about after the Second World War. It was once again brought back after the Second World War. And it features as a fundamental principle of international justice. It is actually also the fundamental component that forms part of the court decisions, specifically against the, you know, regarding the war in Gaza discussion. However, several countries, which includes member nations of the UN, would continue to retain racial discriminatory laws for decades after the end of the Second World War. So, we get into what actually happened in 1919 at the Treaty of Versailles, also known as the Paris Peace Treaty, negotiations or Paris Peace Conference that obviously took place there. Now, Japan attended the 1919 Paris Peace Conference as one of the five great powers that were left. These were obviously now the industrial powers at the time, because if you could build your own armaments, you were considered industrial enough. So Japan was obviously there present as one of the five great powers, and, you know, they were also the only one which was also non-Western, meaning they weren't of a European or a North American flavor, if I could put it that way. Now, the presence of the Japanese delegates in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles, signing the Treaty of Versailles on 28 June 1919, reflected the culmination of a half-century intensive effort by Japan itself, meaning for like 50 years Japan was trying to transform itself into a modern nation at the time, and a modern state that can now participate on the global international stage. So this was, you know, a particular turning point for such a particular country, who is the only non-Western or non-European country in that discussion. You technically have to say it was the only country that was not governed by any particular European settler community, or, you know, had such a large demographic on it. because it was the only, it was an empire state. So, if you had to look into the discussion of domestic politics in Japan, at the time, was that the prime minister that they had at the time, Hara Takashi, had come into power in September of 1918, after the war ended, and was determined for Japan to adopt a pro-Western foreign policy. It was actually known as Obey Kyocho Shugi at the peace conference. Now, that was largely in consequence of the First World War government, under the prime ministers of Okuma, Shigenobu and Teruachi Masatake, whose expansionist policies had the effect of alienating Japan from both the US and Britain. Because the US considers the Pacific Ocean as sort of like its backyard, and the UK obviously had India and all manner of other particular colonies still in the Southeast Asia cluster, alongside the French as well. And remember, and I watched a very lovely explainer infographic video about how many countries has the UK invaded or had colonized at one or other stage in human history. Almost no one is spared. Guys, almost no one. Because the British also stood in as sort of like a security force for the French in Indochina, which is Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia. And those particular indications that I'm explaining to you right there was usually a discussion of how these former superpowers would negotiate with each other in terms of, hey, can you look after my, you know, can you look after that part of my yard while I am over here dealing with a rebellion or some sort of a liberation movement or demonstration situation happening in another part of the world? So, you can get to understand specifically why the British and the Americans would be mentioned as being a slight little bit nervous with regards to Japan's particular existence. So Japan itself in 1918, 1919, anywhere up to the Second World War, building up to the Second World War, they were in a precarious neighborhood. They were in a precarious neighborhood. Because the British were busy, obviously, you know, playing logistical games there in Southeast Asia, because they had the port at Singapore. They had the ports in India. They had the port facilities in, what's that other place's name? It was not Malaysia. They had other port facilities in, I think it was Malaysia. The Dutch were also there. The French were also there. The Americans had the major naval base in the Philippines, because at that stage, it was not yet clear, was the Philippines a full-on colony of the United States? Because if you don't know, the Philippines was one of the particular territories that was taken from the Spanish prior to 1900, was the American-Spanish War, as it was known, which also included the independence of Cuba, which technically meant the Cuban, if I can call them the Cuban independence instigators at the time, they wanted American support, because they felt a lot closer to the US than they were to Spain. And they had indicated, listen, if you help us, and I'm talking about the Cubans before Fidel Castro. I'm not talking about the Cubans from Fidel Castro, guys. I'm here in 1900 or just 1880 something. I'm there currently. So at that time, the Cubans had obviously indicated, because the Monroe Doctrine was ready in full action, the Cubans had obviously indicated to the Americans, hey, listen, let's kick the Spanish out of Cuba. Because Cuba was like the last of the Spanish colonies in the Americas. And the Americans said, fine. But the Americans then asked, hey, listen, we want some of your agricultural sector. We want a part of it. So we want some of our, you know, companies to invest in your agricultural sector in Cuba. So that means the sugarcane company, the cigar or the tobacco companies, because that is one of the largest products of, those are the two largest products of Cuba, sugarcane and tobacco, which is obviously in many cases sold as cigars. It's a very sought after specialist product. So those were some of the particular things that obviously had built up towards the First World War and led into the First World War. And then it was obviously after the First World War that was now being negotiated upon. Now, as you're obviously sitting there, you know, looking at, okay, so there were a lot of things that were feeding into this particular conference that was taking place now in Paris in 1919. Indeed. Now, Takashi, the Prime Minister of the time, was determined to support the creation of the League of Nations at the Peace Conference in order to steer Japan back to the West. So it was pro-West narrative, this, you know, this indication, hey, let's stand with these guys. They supposedly mean well. They are the superpowers of the time. Remember that Russia at the time was not in this conference, so you could not say that Russia was represented. They were not. I told you just a little bit earlier that in 1915 or 1916, obviously the Bolshevik Revolution happened. Now, there's obviously always a snag in these particular negotiations of discussions, because there was quite a bit of skepticism towards the League itself. So meaning, all those nations that showed up there already had mistrust, or they had a little bit, they had major doubts in whether or not this thing could actually work. Now, the domestic opinion in Japan was divided into Japanese who supported the League and Japanese who opposed the League. Because the second, the latter, the guys that opposed it, were more common in national opinion. But the proposal had the role of appeasing the opponents back in domestic Japanese politics by allowing Japan's acceptance of the League to be conditional on having a racial equality clause that would be inserted into the covenant of the League, meaning the foundational document of the League, and it will allow, obviously, all those particular retractors back home in Japan. So it was actually also a political move by the Japanese Prime Minister at the time to recognize that he also had to prove to people back at home that, you know, they could pull this off, because we have to be honest, at the time, this is 1919, you're sitting with a bunch of guys who are the proponents of colonialism. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we are quickly going to step into a short musical break. And after the musical break, we'll come back heading into what is the second half of this morning's programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. And I do hope that you've got a hot cup of brew of something in your palm or in your hand, obviously being clutched, and ensure that you are sipping on it while listening to your number one talk radio station. We'll be back right after these. A short musical break.
I'm just an animal that strains against my line. I push and pull the cord to make me feel alive. To rest the reins back on my life. Here come the stars again. Here come those scars again. How quickly we become the things that we despise. When talked her out of it, another lost a child. So many questions stalking through me day and night. Give me the ghost back. Back. What goes when I relinquish sin? What's that meaning in? What goes when I face who I've been? It's that old grief again.
put your faith in something beautiful. Sell your reflection to the traveling show. We leave ourselves a lot to answer for. I've left myself and now I wanna go home. And up there in your treehouse, pigs and politicians go bumping the night. It'll take more than a Superman to make us think that everything's alright. There's nothing on the radio. They're all talking like they're falling in love. There's nothing on the radio. And it hits me like a fist from above. I'm singing out. Remember all the promises we make, but they're like white noise to us now. We light our match and walk away, we say to ourselves and it's easy. These days are written on our face, and in the faith that we can change the script. You'll know me better than I'll ever know myself if you see me. Take it easy. Nothing on the radio. They're all talking like they're falling in love. Nothing on the radio. And it hits me like a fist from above. I'm singing out.
And coming back there, dear listeners, from the sounds there of Paolo Nutini with the song Radio. Before that, it was Future Islands with the song Give Me the Ghost Back. I almost said Give Me Back the Ghost. So, where we left off specifically with the Paris Peace Deal, or Paris Peace Treaty negotiations and discussions, was obviously we ended up with a discussion on the aspect of what Japanese local politics was like back in that specific period, in and around, during the First World War, and building up to the delegation that left for Paris. Now, here's a specific thing that obviously also played a crucial particular role, because the proposal, when the proposal was made by the Japanese Prime Minister Takashi, it was that the proposal had the role of actually appeasing the opponents back in Japan by allowing Japan's acceptance of the League to be conditional on having this racial equality clause positioned or inserted into it at the covenant or in the covenant. But despite the proposal, Japan itself also had racial discrimination policies back home. They still have. They still do. Well, actually all countries technically in a way have. Especially towards non-Yamato people. Now, if you're going to ask me what does that actually translate to, the non-Yamato people, or the Yamato or the Wajin, are an East Asian ethnic group that comprises of about 98% of the population of Japan. Now, the genetic and anthropometric studies have shown that the Yamato people predominantly descend from the Yayoi people, who migrated to Japan from Asia, meaning from the continent. And this was during a specific period where obviously there was a mass migration that happened, or if it is known as a mass migration, it was around the first millennium BC. And to a lesser extent, the indigenous Jomon people, who had inhabited the Japanese archipelago for thousands of years before then. So the Jomon were a prehistoric hunter-gatherer culture that inhabited the Japanese archipelago between approximately 14,000 BC to 300 BC. And this obviously was following which they were largely assimilated by migrants from the mainland East Asia of the following Yayoi culture. So, just to set that particular scene, it obviously had to explain, you know, give insights in terms of, you know, this particular proposal. So, the proposal at hand, which obviously came about. Now, after the end of seclusion in the 1850s, that's obviously after Japan's particular isolationist period or policies fell in the 1850s, Japan signed unequal treaties. And these treaties were called the Ansei Treaties, but soon came to demand equal status from the Western powers. Specifically correcting that inequality became the most urgent international issue of the Meiji government. And in that context, the Japanese delegation to the Paris Peace Conference proposed the clause in the Covenant of the League of Nations, because they knew what it felt like having foreign soldiers on their soil. It's one of the reasons also why Namibia has the same particular clause in its constitution, that no foreign army should be on our shores or should be in our country. No foreign army. Yes, you can have, what do you call that thing, strategic scenarios in terms of they obviously being partners that help with training and stuff like that, you know, on our side. But in our constitution, it says no foreign army may be on our, or may be in our country. No foreign army. So, the first draft was presented to the League of Nations Commission on 13 February as an amendment to Article 21. Now, Article 21 read, after the particular amendment was then laid forward in terms of the first draft, that the equality of nations being a basic principle of the League of Nations, the high contracting parties agree to accord as soon as possible to all alien nationals of states, members of the League, equal and just treatment in every respect, making no distinction, either in law or in fact, on account of their race or nationality. Now, in a speech, the Japanese diplomat that was obviously, you know, also present, that's now Makino Nobuaki, stated that during the war, men of different races had fought together on the Allied side, leading to say, a common bond of sympathy and gratitude has been established to an extent never before experienced. Now, the Japanese delegation had not realized the full ramifications of their proposal, because they obviously came there and negotiated as an independent country. And they made their proposals, you know, they made just their suggestions and they made their stuff. Japan was actually a great supplier, in great part, to many of the countries that actually fought in the First World War. They weren't actually a fighting nation. They were a supplier of, you know, of supplies. So, in terms of not fully realizing, you know, what their proposal actually culminated in or was about to spring forth, because since its adoption would have challenged aspects of the established norms of the day of Western-dominated international system, which would involve the colonial rule over non-white people back then, which, as I explained to you as the precursor issue, was the issue. Now, the intention of the Japanese was to secure equality of their nationals and the equality for members of the League of Nations. But a universalist meaning and implication of the proposal became attached to it within the delegation, which drove its contentiousness at the conference. So, after Makino's speech, there was another, you know, another diplomat that also came and spoke about this, the thing. This was obviously a British lawyer and politician and diplomat. His name was Edgar Algernon Robert Gascoigne Cecil, who was actually also known as Lord Robert Cecil, stated that the Japanese proposal was a very controversial one, and he suggested that perhaps the matter was so controversial that it should not be discussed at all. So firstly, you had a British diplomat firstly sort of like trying to contest this particular proposal. Then stepped up the Greek prime minister at the time, Eleftherios Venizelos, who also suggested that a clause banning religious discrimination should also be removed, since that was also a very controversial one. Now, you would ask me, why would the Greek come and ask for the banning of religious discrimination? Now, remember, dear listeners, the League of Nations was the precursor to the UN. The League of Nations Covenant was the precursor to the UN Charter. You had colonial powers negotiating things in the League of Nations scenario, and they were unhappy with some suggestions, proposals, and discussions popping up. Whereas in the UN Charter, to be a colonial power was technically a no. It was technically saying, hey, listen, you can't call yourself an upholder or a defender of equal rights if you're the one that has colonial possessions in Africa and other parts of the world, and you're not allowing the peoples in those particular zones or territories and the likes the ability to chart their own destiny as a country. So, Eleftherios Venizelos, the Greek prime minister of the time, if you don't know why he would make such a suggestion, let me help you. So, Greece was one of the territories that the Ottomans had attacked. And ever since Alexander the Great, the Greeks and the Persians, or the Ottomans, because the Ottomans are supposedly, if you look at them in terms of their genealogy, they are somewhat Persian-ish, slash, they're not Arab. I'll tell you now, the Persians, the Ottomans, or the Turkish today, they're not Arab. They are not. They are considered more Slavic, because the people that the, like the Serbs, that you find here in the Balkans are, you know, those population, those European population groups that you find here in the Balkans are more related to the Ottomans. But the Ottomans have a particular sort of like a Persian-ish root or Persian-ish ancestry. So if you don't know what Persia is what we now know as Iran. Now, you can draw the line of contention in terms of what the Greek prime minister at the time, Eleftherios Venizelos, was trying to achieve when he said, hey, remove that thing that says the banning of religious discrimination. Why? Because Greece is Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, and much of the conflict between Greece and Turkey, or the Ottomans, Greece and the Ottomans, Greece and the Turkish, in modern times after the Second World War was primarily based upon the dispute over Cyprus or Malta? One of the two island nations, Cyprus or Malta. And the dispute comes about because one half of that island, one of those two islands, is Turkish, and the other half of that, of one of those two islands, is Greek. You have a Greek side to it, and you have a Turkish side to it. And each of the Greek and the Turkish governments, even till the day, support those two sides on that island. Now, at one stage, Greece was a colony of the Ottomans. Not of Turkey, of the Ottomans. Of the Ottoman Empire. And there were all these particular machinations obviously going on and discussions like that. So, Greece in itself obviously felt that it was now in a strong position to start with its particular religious discrimination. So there you had your next particular stumbling block. First you had that British diplomat who didn't feel that there should be such a particular clause because of the UK's colonial possessions that it still had at the time. And secondly, you had other guys starting an argument themselves because they didn't like each other based upon their religious dispositions. Now, getting back to the British diplomat Cecil, Cecil removed all references to clauses that forbade racial and religious discrimination from the text of the peace treaty. But the Japanese made it clear that they would seek to have the clause restored. Now, remember, they were the drafters, these other guys. They were giving inputs on the ground, and then the draft comes back to the people who gave their suggestions and all the parties to the discussion. And then everyone would sit there reading the thing, and then they would go like, but you removed something. Why did you remove this particular clause? Now, as mentioned, removed all the references to clauses that forbade. All the references to clauses that forbade racial and religious discrimination from the text of the peace treaty. That's significant. That is completely significant because there would be a reason as to why you put in a clause or you put in something, because you have to motivate to whoever comes along 100 years later and this document is still in effect or still in power, and you have to ask the question, why was this clause here? Why is this particular stipulation here? So, by then, the clause was beginning to draw widespread public attention. Because demonstrations in Japan demanded the end of the badge of shame, as policies to exclude Japanese immigration in the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand received much attention in Japanese media back then. So if you guys don't know what actually also went along back then, if you've never heard from a grandfather or the likes who, you know, was worldly at the time, you know, there were a few negative things that happened just after the First World War, or building up to the First World War scenarios. So, in many cases, if you go and read someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, the American writer and essayist, Du Bois felt very much like a human, as an accepted human, when he went to Paris and to Berlin before the First World War. Reason being specifically because at that stage there was, you know, there was a very vibrant culture in terms of expressions and the arts and the likes in these two aspects of Europe. But he was still registered as a second class citizen specifically in the USA, which was his home country. Now, we translate that similar particular thinking, that similar particular process to a Japanese national of the time. To a South African, to a native Canadian, to a Maori, to an Aborigine from Australia, a Maori from New Zealand. If you go into, for example, the recent discussions that obviously have been taking place in New Zealand, has been the talk of what has happened with the... There was a protest last year wherein It's a local social movement between the Maori in New Zealand, and they were basically protesting that the adherence to the original contract or agreement between the British Crown and the Maori traditional authorities must be adhered to, specifically based upon land. Now, it's the same thing in Namibia's particular genocide discussion. However, it now seems that that particular discussion is taking a different twist to things, and I'm still trying to keep my eye on it in terms of seeing what the next particular developments actually are. Because there's, in a Namibian context, there's a lot of things happening. Well, it's not a lot, it's just, it seems to head in a particular direction, and this is obviously in line with what the AU theme for this 2025 was, or is, because 2025 is still active. But it's in that similar particular scenario. So for now, I won't get into contemporary talking points, meaning today talking points. I'm staying on things of yesteryear. Now, why I mentioned New Zealand specifically is that in the 1800s, the British Crown had to negotiate something with the Maori war tribes, or the Maori tribes in New Zealand, regarding, or they were trying to put a stop, obviously, to the fighting between the British settlers and the Maori tribes. So, in a lovely little documentary that I watched last year, was it in 2023? There actually exists two versions of the same particular treaty. The one that is in the English and that is held in London says a completely different thing than the one that is held in Maori and held and contained in Wellington, New Zealand. What does the two things actually say? The one in English says supposedly that the Maori have given permission to the British Crown for settlers, to European settlers or British settlers, to occupy various places of land throughout New Zealand. Whereas the one that's in Maori, held in New Zealand, says that the British settlers have to ask for permission to settle on land. So, just so that you know, I'm summarizing things because, obviously, you know, to keep it as short and sweet as possible. Now, that firstly must explain to you, dear listeners, remember, this is before the First World War. That should explain to you what the flavor of negotiations, the viewpoints, the treatments of peoples, specifically indigenous populations of various parts of the world, how they were being approached, how they were being treated, and specifically, if you look at the discussion of rights, obviously the discussion of rights has various entry points to look at from. For example, the Japanese were independent, but the Maori are not independent. The Japanese were an independent nation, but the native Canadians were in their reservations. And the reservations are not recognized by any international law as a country. It's the same thing for the Native American groups in the U.S. Reservations are separate from the U.S. federal state, from the U.S. government. They are separate. However, there are certain exceptions in terms of where the law enforcement can, you know, they can intervene in certain scenarios. But in many cases, the reservations of the Native American reservations in the U.S. feature as autonomous zones in the U.S. Autonomous zones where not even the Army of the United States enters into in terms of conducting anything. Only, as I said, on severe exceptions. I use the word severe because the exception has to be one of either it's women and child abuse and cruelty aspects that are taking place and things like that, or, you know, one other particular thing is just getting out of control, which is a major negative. However, the badge of shame that the Japanese immigrants had experienced back then was when they wanted to move to places like the United States. Now, if you don't know, during the Second World War, many Japanese American immigrants or families were placed in concentration camps by the American army in the US because the US and the Japanese were at war. Which was one of the particular problematic scenarios because the Americans didn't do the same for any particular German immigrants or families during the same period. The Americans didn't do the same for, I mean, not even for any people that had any distinct aspect of even Russian lineage or any of that sort, even during the Cold War. But they did it to Japanese immigrant or the Japanese population or the Japanese communities that had moved from Japan to the US. They had done that to them. Now, when you sit and look at this particular scenario, you get to understand technically what was the aspect of, when it came to racial equality, why this was such a contentious point and why this was technically the reason as to why the Second World War began. Now, in the US, the clause received much negative media coverage on the West Coast. The West Coast is obviously the side of California on the Pacific Ocean side. The Chinese delegation, which was otherwise in bitter enmity with the Japanese over the question of the former German colony of Qingdao, because the Chinese were also there. But remember, there were also parts of China that were occupied by European powers, like Macau that was occupied by the Portuguese, Hong Kong obviously occupied by the British, Shanghai was some sort of a neutral zone, but it was also somewhat majority administered by the British as well, because it's a port city as well. If you don't know, one of Britain's oldest banks or largest banks, HSBC, its name actually stands for Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC. I think it's the only one that whose headquarters was not in London. It was outside of London, outside of the UK. So when you look at this particular scenario, this particular, if I can call it sort of like a, not a portrait, because a portrait is of one face, of one identity, but this particular collage that I just constructed for you right now, you get an insight in terms of, so, at the heart of everything, there was those that were trying to deal with racism and those that were trying to maintain racism. I'll call it for what it is specifically. Now, the particular former German possessions that were obviously in on the Chinese mainland at the time were Qingdao and the German concessions in the Shandong province in China as well. And the Chinese delegation also said that it would support the particular clause for racial equality. So it's surprising specifically to see, you know, two particular, you know, states for a great part had a shared history, which was not at best, at the best levels in terms of, you know, the historical references or various points in history. The Chinese and the Japanese weren't always the best of neighbors. Now, the Australian Prime Minister that traveled there, obviously, as I mentioned to you in a little bit earlier in the first half of today's discussion, Billy Hughes actually went and clarified his particular position and announced at the meeting that 95 out of 100 Australians had rejected the very idea of equality. Now, I don't know where he had a poll, but he obviously just stood up and announced that. Because he was actually running a strategically not so nice policy, immigration policy back home. The immigration policy that he was running was known as the White Australia Immigration Policy. So what was this policy about? The White Australia Policy was a set of racial policies that was aimed to forbid people of non-European ethnic origins, meaning Asian and Pacific Islanders, from immigrating to Australia And in order to create a white British local or ideal focused on, but not exclusively, Anglo-Celtic peoples. Now Hughes, the Australian Prime Minister, had actually entered politics as a trade unionist. This is a trade unionist of the 1900s, not a trade unionist of, you know, from the Cold War this way. He entered as a trade unionist back then in the 1900s, and like most other trade unionists or politicians who were from the working class at the time, was very strongly opposed to Asian immigration to Australia. Now, the exclusion of Asian immigration was a popular cause with unions in Canada, in the United States, in Australia, and in New Zealand. Specifically in that first, that part before the First World War. Because in many parts, dear listeners, the global powers of the time, which included the UK, and Germany and France, even the Netherlands, even Portugal and Spain, what they would do is they would allow some sort of a, if I can call it an economic immigration facility to exist between a colonial territory and the country, their home country. What do I mean by that? So, they would facilitate a scenario for specifically, let's say there was need for farm workers back in one of the provinces, let's say, of France. They would facilitate a notion in terms of saying, people who would like to move from, let's say, Vietnam were allowed to get on this facility and then go and work on the wine farms or the agricultural sector in France itself. And this particular mechanism, this particular, you know, aspect was one of the things that the American working class was against, because the American working class felt and believed for that time that they should be the only ones that should have access to work. But the American working class in that scenario had to contend with Spanish working class or Mexican working class as well, because you had Mexican farm workers that would walk across the border into the US, get jobs on most of those southern farms in the US, which were cattle farms, which were plantations, the likes. And obviously that's after the abolition of slavery in the US was achieved, obviously, in the a good 30, 40 years beforehand. And that obviously sets the scene in terms of understanding that, you will always have these migrant working populations going about. The New Zealanders didn't like the idea, obviously, because they obviously also wanted to contain all economic activity to the settler communities that of, you know, in New Zealand. The same for Australia. The same it probably is surprising that South Africa wasn't one of them that actually was against it. The same for the British, the same for the Canadians. But here's the downside, dear listeners, which is the literal thing that's happening currently today. In many cases, your population will progress in terms of its living standards, in terms of its incomes, and in terms of the services that it consumes. The next generations born out of the current or contemporary population, households or population of households in your country will then not want to work in the farming sector, will not want to work in the construction sector, will not want to work in the trades sector. What am I saying to you? Let's, for example, say you are a plumber today. And let's say, for example, say you and your household, you guys live together. You obviously have children. That's now you and your partner. And the children are going to school every day. They've got food on their table every day. They are being picked up and dropped off, and they can enjoy a fruitful particular upbringing in terms of, you know, reaching all the way up until the age of 19. At 19, the child says, that they want to become a doctor or a lawyer, or they want to go study a commerce degree or get into this particular aspect, which is completely different from the trade you are doing. Remember I said that you're a plumber. The child wants to be something else. And the child, it's the child's right, whatever they wish to achieve. The downside is, it literally shows you that you had a bracket of talent and a bracket of workers in this particular trade, and now you will not have a replacement for, let's for example say, when you retire. Now, it's one of these particular things that is not also being, you can actually see it in Namibia's particular economic planning. The planning is broad-based, saying, you know, jobs must be achieved here. But the question you have to ask yourself is, who's going to work there? If much of the working population, or future working population and current working population, are all mostly contained within urban settings, who's going to work there? Who's going to work in that landscape? Who's going to do that particular job? Now, as I obviously described that particular scenario to you, Billy Usett stood up and said literally that 95 out of 100 Australians had rejected the idea of racial equality. And obviously he was busy running his white Australia immigration policy back home that had been adopted in 1901. And he wrote, "No government could live for a day in Australia if it tampered with a white Australia." That's what Hughes actually stated. And he said, the position is this. Either the Japanese proposal means something or it means nothing. If the former, out with it. If the latter, why have it? The New Zealand Prime Minister at the time, William Massey, also came out in opposition to the clause, though not as vociferously as Hughes. Why? Specifically because obviously he knows that the particular constitution of New Zealand is based upon that, two-tongued agreement that I mentioned to you a little bit earlier. You can go read up on that agreement. It's actually the same particular document that led to protests last year in New Zealand once again. It led to the protest the previous year as well. The one that I referenced. The one of last year was when the lawmaker, she's like 31 or 30 or 28 years old, the Maori lawmaker who tore up the proposal that was put forward by the current Prime Minister of New Zealand. I don't know that man's name. But he wanted to amend that particular founding document to say that all New Zealanders are the same and that they are technically the same people. And she was like going on a basis of saying, no, there is an aspect of racial difference between that statement, because they were still debating the aspect of indigenous versus...
Who are we, you ask? The National Road Safety Council is a statutory body established in 1996 with a legal mandate to promote and manage road safety across Namibia. We believe every accident is preventable and every life is precious. Our mission is to make our roads, vehicles, and users safer based on effective road safety management. So, join our unwavering vision and commitment to zero deaths and serious injuries. Visit www.nrsc.org.na to learn more. Do the right thing and save lives.
So coming back there from the short ad break, dear listeners, and obviously bringing you into the sort of like the last third. No, not the last 15 minutes of today's particular discussion here in your number one talk radio station, obviously, as we always do here on your Sunday mornings, specifically on my Sunday morning take. We get into the discussions regarding the importance of what, or the understanding to what actually led to the downfall of the League of Nations, because at the heart, you can't have everyone participating in a party, but you've got certain special persons based upon whatever reasoning, as opposed to everyone being considered equal, and that you've got no two-tier or multiple-tier scenarios actually taking place. Now, this then gets us into our particular sort of like last leg of our program, where after the, if I can call it, the defenses that were put up by the various politicians from, you know, from the British Dominion states. So that obviously means New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the likes. The Japanese diplomat, Makino Nobuaki, the Korea diplomat who headed the Japanese delegation, then announced at a press conference, "We are not too proud to fight, but we are too proud to accept a place of admitted inferiority in dealing with one or more of the associated nations. We want nothing but simple justice." Now, France declared its support for the proposal, since the French position had always been that the French language and the culture was a civilizing force open to all regardless of skin color. Now, if you guys remember, I explained to you back in last year the aspect of understanding, you know, what is happening in West Africa, and that many particular English-speaking peoples, for specifically in the African media discussion, don't really understand why you have such a strong French presence in terms of French culture in French-speaking West Africa and what it actually is born from. And I explained to you that Charles de Gaulle, after the Second World War, put through the heads of state of these African countries in West Africa, put forth a, what's the thing's name? A referendum. Put forward a referendum so that the populations of those African countries had the opportunity of being asked the question, do you still want to be in the French, consider it the French Commonwealth? No, the French community, sorry, that's its new name. Do you still want to be in the French community? Do you want to have independence in terms of you make your, chart your own course and all that other particular thing? Do you still want your head of state to be a honorary member of the French Parliament? Do you want your economic affairs to be governed from out of Paris? And there was another one. Do you want to have one or other particular thing itself in terms of your own national identity? Most of those countries, except for, I think it's Burkina Faso, said yes, they will stay in the French community, and they would like their presidents to sit in the French Parliament as honorary parliamentarians. Only one country literally said no. That was, as I mentioned, Burkina Faso. So if you hear weird things about, why does it look like France is trying to influence and interfere in scenarios, it's because way back in the 1950s, Charles de Gaulle had asked the African states back then, do you guys still want to be part of the French community? And do you still want to maintain some of these particular perks? They were asked. Most of them said yes. It has continued up until 2020, into 2024, 2023. So, back to the aspect in terms of the, you know, the obvious sort of like, if I can call it the reflections provided by these politicians and diplomats. The British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George at the time, found himself in an awkward position or situation since Britain had signed an alliance with Japan in 1902. So he can't stand against Japan because they signed that alliance. But he also wanted to hold the British Empire's delegation together. So he wanted to still be seen as sort of like the big brother in discussion with the other guys, the other British territories. South African Prime Minister of the time, General Jan Smuts and the Canadian Prime Minister, Robert Borden, tried to work out a compromise by visiting Makino and Chinda Sutemi and Hughes, serving as mediators. Now, Borden and Smuts were able to arrange a meeting between Makino, Chinda, and Hughes, which ended badly because the Japanese diplomats wrote that Hughes was a vulgar peasant who was loud and obnoxious, and Hughes complained that the Japanese had been beslobbering me with genuflections and obsequious deference, which technically means he didn't see much emotion from them, and he also what I can read from this particular sentence was that he felt that they were speaking down to him. Well, at most, in many cases, the Japanese politicians of the time, just in the 1919s, were mostly of samurai heritage or lineage, which would have made them, in most cases, nobility. So they obviously would speak down to someone who came through as a trade unionist and obviously was from a working class background. So yeah, unfortunately. Borden and Smuts were able to persuade Hughes to accept the clause if it was declared that it did not affect immigration. Makino and Chinda then rejected that particular compromise. The vote then comes through on 11 April 1919. Now, this is as the commission held a final session. Makino stated that the Japanese plea for human rights and racial equality must be maintained. The British representative, Robert Cecil, spoke for the British Empire and addressed opposition to the proposal. The Italian Prime Minister of the time, Vittorio Orlando, spoke in favor of the statement on human rights. The French senator at the time, Léon Bourgeois, urged its adoption and stated that it would be impossible to reject the proposal, which embodied an indisputable principle of justice. The proposal received a majority vote on the day, with 11 of the 17 delegates present voted in favor of its amendment to the charter, and no negative vote was taken. However, you had Japan, yes with 2, France, yes with 2, Italy, yes with 2, Brazil, yes, China, yes, Greece, yes, Serbia, yes, Czechoslovakia, yes. You had the British Empire that did not register a vote. Its vote was not registered. The United States, they sat with 2 delegates there, with two votes, not registered. Portugal, with 1 vote, not registered. Romania, with 1 vote, not registered. And Belgium, with 2 votes, was absent. Now, the chairman, Woodrow Wilson, the American president of the time, overturned it by saying that although the proposal had been approved by a clear majority, the particular matter had strong opposition manifest itself. Despite the lack of any actual votes against the proposal, and that on this issue, a unanimous vote would be required. The French delegate, Ferdinand Lanaud, immediately stated that a majority had voted for the amendment. Meanwhile, the Japanese delegation wanted the transcript to show that a clear majority had been voted for in the amendment. Though the proposal itself was compatible with the British stance of equality for all subjects as a principle for maintaining imperial unity, there were significant deviations in the stated interests of its dominions, notably Australia, as it risked undermining the White Australia policy. Billy Hughes and Joseph Cook was Billy Hughes's, I think, number 2, in terms of the Australian government at the time, because Joseph Cook later on became the next Australian Prime Minister after Hughes, and apparently Hughes was known as the longest serving, is known as the longest serving Australian Prime Minister, in Australia's history. Now, Billy Hughes and Joseph Cook vigorously opposed the proposal behind the scenes and actually advocated against it through the British delegation. Without the support of its dominions, the British delegation could not take such a stand on principle. Now, according to the diary of Cecil, that's now obviously of Robert Cecil, the delegate representing the British Empire at the conference, he stated, It is curious how all the foreigners perpetually harp on principle and right and other abstractions, whereas the Americans and still more the British are only considering what will give the best chance to the league of working properly. So the British and the Americans didn't care about what does the league stand for. They didn't care, according to Cecil. Which actually is a little bit of a shocker, because this technically meant that if you called yourself the League of Nations, does it mean that the British and the French were allowed to continue with their colonialism? To placate Japan, because the word placate technically means almost to sort of like appease you, you know, sort of like in some way allow a little bit of a compromise, and some way allow to not shush you, but rather to say, hey, listen, we will find a way to make you happy or to calm you down. So to placate Japan, Wilson promised to support the Japanese claims on the former German possessions in China, and said that it would be Japan's reward for accepting the rejection of the proposal. Now right there, Woodrow Wilson is once again starting with a game of colonialism by trying to dish out territories for something that the Japanese did not ask for. Because according to the literature that exists, the Americans and the Australians and the British felt that the Japanese probably were trying to sort of like extend or play their own particular colonizing game or colonialism game there in the Pacific realm. On top of this, over the advice of the United States Navy, Wilson also agreed to support the Japanese claims to the Marianas, the Marshall Islands, and the Caroline Islands in the Pacific Ocean, which later on, 20 years later, the Americans would be fighting the Japanese for those islands, which was known as the, what is it? Is the Guadalcanal. Yeah. So, in essence, those islands were taken back by the Americans. So once again, showing to you a little bit of a weird aspect in terms of how these negotiations then later on fizzled out in terms of giving countries or territories or island nation states or small island territories and zones just to appease someone. But here's the thing, dear listeners. It still did not sort out at the heart of the discussion the racial equality scenario. It didn't. Now, on that particular note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end or the top of the hour at 7 a.m. here on my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station. Obviously, it does get us into the next particular aspect in terms of, firstly, I'll have to welcome you and wish you good morning once again if you've just woken up in this lovely 7 a.m. scenario here on the Sunday morning, which is the first Sunday of the new month of August. And obviously, you have been in my company from 5 a.m. up until now, and that having been the my Sunday morning take here on the number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. We turn to the musical break, and obviously, we'll see each other again during the course of the week on the home run, where myself and Helmut will obviously dissect and get into the very interesting conversations and discussions that you can find that we always host and conduct with. And obviously, there's the further on discussions if you are wishing to catch me on Sunday mornings, specifically next week, Sunday, once again. On that note, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company as we obviously bring to you some of the insightful programming as always.